Hey, Tom, you're our sales pro. Tell us about your podcast.
Do you have many boomers that are rebels?
Believe it or not, one of my first clients was a boomer.
All right, I want you to turn me into a rebel today.
I'm a Philly girl. I listen to Rocky, and I'm going up those stairs, man, and I could do anything.
And I came back from corporate, and I sat at the desk, and I actually had to do sales, and I was mortified.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today for OK Boomer, Teach Me Sales. I'm Kelly Bloomer.
And I'm Tom Bloomer.
OK, Tom, you're our sales pro. In 30 words or less, can you tell us about this podcast?
I'm going to try. You know, us salespeople like to talk, Kelly.
You sure do.
All right, 30 words or less.
Can you do it?
Well, if you're a sales pro and you're looking to grow in your sales career, if you like good, lively sales discussion, I think this is going to be a show for you. I've walked your walk for over 30 years in sales. I've knocked on the doors and overcome the same obstacles I think you may be facing as a seller, a sales manager, and as a VP of sales. I currently help assess, build, and train high-performing media sales teams. Well, Kel?
Yeah, you really went over 30 words.
But I think it was good.
I do too.
Okay, so I hope our listeners will be all set. And hey, let's roll up our shirt sleeves and let's get at it.
So enjoy listening to Tom and his guests talk sales.
So Kelly, who's the boomer on the show today?
You're asking me today?
I thought there'd be a nice change of pace.
Oh, well, we actually have two boomers today.
Two?
Two.
And who would they be?
Well, you've worked with them. I'll give you a little hint.
Are we continuing our media organization series?
Yes, we are. And today we're going to be talking with the guys from Mint Magazine.
Tell me more.
Okay. Well, Mint Magazine was co-founded by Brian Flynn and Brian McCaffrey, not to get anybody confused about a Brian, in 1988, during the infancy of desktop publishing and technology. They operated very profitably for 18 years prior to selling to Gannett, which also brought in Clipper Magazine in 2005. At the time of the sale, Mint Magazine had over 55 employees publishing in Jacksonville and Tampa, Florida, Columbia, South Carolina, Chattanooga, and Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yes, they did, Kelly. It was quite an organization. I still remember when they joined Clipper. And you know what's really interesting? They have 32 years of direct mail publishing experience. And Flynn and McCaffrey, they brought a unique set of entrepreneurial qualifications, experience, and passion to their company. When they joined Clipper, they brought that passion to our company. In fact, they are the ones that persuaded Clipper to enter the online deal business. They developed and launched Double Take Deals. They developed that website, launched it in Jacksonville, Florida in 2010, and they worked closely with all aspects of the development. And that website and program is still running at Clipper today, known as Local Flavor.
We've used that quite often.
Yeah, we have. And they started it for us in 2010. Great guys. They bring all that experience, and they have a lot to share with our listeners today.
Well, then let's listen.
Let's go. Well, actually, Kel, you know, I probably should warn our listeners before we just let's go.
Okay.
This episode, we had a little bit of audio trouble.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So who had the audio trouble?
Which Brian, right?
Well, there are two.
They sounded great.
Fantastic.
They both came out great. They sounded great. They had no audio. They've never been on a podcast before. They had no audio issues. Guess who had the audio issues?
The person who's been doing this for a little while?
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to apologize to our listeners up front. Great content. You're going to hear great things from the Bryans. You're going to hear them great. You're going to notice a few audio issues with our mic.
Okay.
We had just made some changes. I apologize up front, but the show must go on, and it's a good one.
All right, let's listen.
Well, we began our interview with Brian Flynn and Brian McCaffrey. I asked them a very simple question. Why print advertising? How did you get started in print advertising? And we learned something very interesting. And I'll ask all of you, what was the best sale you've ever made? Not the biggest sale. I'm not saying the hardest sale you had to overcome something. But was there a sale that really changed your career or changed your life? Well, when I asked them why they got started with print advertising, we quickly learn one of the best sales Brian Flynn ever made.
Well, let me respond to that. I was running a car wash at the time, true story. And it was Brian Flynn that, kind of suckered me into the print business. So I'm going to let Brian take it from here, because why the print business? And then he was the best sales job he ever did on me was to get me to come into the business. So,
well, it was really both of our creations, because I didn't publish a magazine until we were together. I had started selling and I had a partner at the time, but he decided he wanted to chase his girlfriend more than he wanted to sell. So I was out there selling and he wasn't. And I walked and he and I separated before we put out the first publication. And I went and called on Irv at the car wash and we started talking. He goes, "Well, I think I might be moving back to Ohio." I said, "Well, I got a deal for you." So we literally went over to my apartment. We sat, I'm not even sure that I had any furniture in there. I think I had already moved it out.
No furniture. It wasn't very impressive, Tom. It didn't give me a lot of confidence.
But I did sell him. I sold him. We became partners. And literally, that's how we started, Tom. And I was going to put a first publication out in September of 88. We waited and put it. Actually, our first publication came out the first week in January of 1989. And we went from there. But that was probably the best sale I ever made.
Yeah, I love Ohio. I love Cleveland, where I was from, the Akron-Cleveland area. But there was nothing at that time that I was going to go back to Ohio for, having living in Florida. So he could have offered me a soybean partnership, and I would have taken it.
In most young companies, there comes a moment when you need to adapt, when you need to understand there's some changes that may be necessary for your growth. We learned from Brian and Brian, Mint Magazine wasn't always called Mint Magazine. And there's an interesting story of how that came to be.
No, the first magazine was actually called Automate. Our thinking was, how do you get to any of these establishments? So it was the mate in your car. And we had called it Automate. And we did that for the first 2 years until January of 1991, I believe. Mm-hmm. We switched and became, or February of 91, we became Mint Magazine at that point.
Hey, Tom and Brian, you got to remember when we were called Automate, because we were originally only going to make it a niche magazine for the automotive industry. So we were going to be exclusively selling advertising to automotive related businesses, anything from, you can think of in the automotive space.
Car wash.
And we had this client who was our biggest customer at the time, wonderful guy, Ed O'Neill, and he had a chain of oil lube changes. Brian had met him and he had the vision to look at us and go, "Why are you limiting this magazine to automotive?" He said, "Why not put food in it and give it more of a day-to-day use?" And he was the first guy that ever said that to us. And he was spot on. And so we just kind of molded the name, Brian. Remember, we just Automate was keep it in your car and save. So we just kind of make it your Automate. And that was how we spun it from being an exclusive automotive magazine to really selling any kind of direct mail industry, consumer oriented.
So along with a name change, we learned very quickly that in the early days of Mint Magazine, there were a lot of things that needed to be developed to turn it into the company it became. When the Bryans first started Mint Magazine, full color print ads were not the norm. And I asked Brian about that.
No, it wasn't the norm. And we actually got right on the precipice of it, literally coming out there, Tom, very beginning. And that was, we had some long nights trying to figure out how to output stuff in color.
Well, you got to really talk about it. We bought the second Macintosh model ever manufactured, and neither one of us knew how to use the Macintosh computer. We didn't take any classes. Neither one of us would reuse the manual. So we'd sit around the house and take turns till 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, trying to figure out how to make an ad with this thing called a Macintosh computer. So it was really, I think truly, and I've said this to many people, I said, I could thank Steve Jobs for our career, because without that computer, we wouldn't be in business. I mean, and I'm sure there's thousands of other stories like that. But that was the unique thing about that very beginning. $2,500 each. It was our investment into our company.
And we actually, so the first Mac we used, though, we borrowed from somebody and then we wouldn't give it back to them.
Mm-hmm. So you got to do what you can, right?
Until we could afford to put the first publication out, and then we were able to buy one.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like in the community then? So, you know, I look at the present, and Florida has always been one of the most competitive areas I've ever seen in the country. You know, there are a lot of direct mail options, a lot of print, a lot of advertising in general. Was it that competitive back then? Like, was there a company you looked at and said, this is what we want to be? What was the landscape like when you first started?
Yeah, Tom, the original coupon magazine in the United States that we know of was out of Columbus, Ohio, and they became Paper Mint. So the Paper Mint name, we had them as a competitor here locally in Jacksonville. And that's when we changed our name to Mint. They had a partnership falling apart, and we actually became partners with them in our Jacksonville market. So we transferred from Paper Mint and Automate to Mint Magazine.
Okay.
And that's how they were a very formidable competitor. I mean, and back in the time though, you didn't have direct mail that came out weekly or monthly. Direct mail then was quarterly. So that's all publications came out at the time, because they were very difficult to put together, because you had to output a black and white sheet, then you had to do the overlay of color onto it, and then they had to strip the film. So the process was very time consuming and expensive.
How many of them were you mailing out? So you have a time-consuming process, but then how many were you producing at that point?
Well, we were mailing, in Jacksonville, we were mailing 265,000 was our initial distribution. But we were putting out different zones. So it was just, initially, it was just Irv and I working. And I think we had back then, Irv, six or eight zones?
In Jacksonville, yeah.
Then a regional. And our competitors... So our competitors on the zones, they were only doing black and white. And we actually came out and were doing color on the zones also. And that helped us a lot, because it differentiated within those local advertisers. They could then see their ad in full color, where with our competitors, they couldn't. So we did that for the first 2 years. We came out quarterly. And then we literally went to 12 or 10 times a year from there, or 8 times a year from there. So we went from quarterly to 8 times, and that was in 91 or 90.
To reiterate what Brian said, we were completely full color, and that really gave us a competitive advantage in the marketplace, and we didn't have any overhead. It was just two young guys out hustling, and we figured out enough of the technology to be dangerous at the time from a competitive standpoint. And, you know, I think really it was just, you know, at that time, it was just a work ethic. I mean, we just were out selling as much as we can. And, you know, but if you really look at before that, Brian, what really kind of launched us and it saved the day for us is our second mailing or printing of Automate magazine arrived at the post office, the 265,000 copies in an 18 wheeler. And the post office called us and said, you need to get down here to the bulk mail center right away. These magazines are falling apart. And we didn't know what they meant by falling apart, but we literally showed up and they started taking pallets off this truck, and these magazines weren't even stitched together in some places, or it looked like they had just given them all to, you know, hundreds of third graders and said, here's a pair of scissors, see what you can do with these things.
They weren't cut square. I mean, it was terrible.
So we got this, and so the post office, and they would never do this today, actually spent the time to sift through what they could mail and what they could actually deliver. And we then took the extras that they had that were falling apart literally and spent about 2 weeks cutting coupons from these magazines. So we had bags and bags and bags of coupons of our customers.
I see where this is going, Irv, but go ahead.
And the mail out happened, we needed these customers to get response. So this is kind of very funny. We would hide in the bushes in some instances by businesses, and as customers came walking into the business, we dart out from behind the bush and hand them a coupon, and they go back into the bush like an armadillo. It was pretty funny, but it actually was effective. We took our best advertisers and tried to flood them with coupons on our second printing. And what I was going to finish the story here was the printer, for some reason, and I won't mention the printer's name, I don't even know if they're in business, so it doesn't matter, but they basically fronted us the print job. They didn't even ask for a deposit, which was saved us, because when we ended up negotiating out that this print job was horrible, we shouldn't pay you anything, we settled on 50%. Well, the 50% savings that we had cash flowed our business, and that's how we survived.
And we didn't have to pay it for a year.
So without that, that which so you look at a negative in your business early on, which was catastrophic, quite honestly, turned out to be the best single thing that ever happened to us early on in our business. That was before the Mint Magazine merger with Paperman.
That is an amazing story. And, you know, I was going to ask you later what has changed in sales, but you already answered. Nowadays, I don't think people can hide in bushes and jump out. So that's an old school technique, I think, there.
Well, it takes some skill, Tom. You got to be able to get in and get out quick, you know.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the business owners. You said you're two young guys. You're running around. You're hustling. You're working really hard. You're going into a lot of seasoned businesses, right? And you have a new publication, something they've never seen, heard of. Walk us through some of those initial presentations. That could not have been easy to get your point across and show them what you were doing.
I'll make a comment. I personally had zero sales, you know, formal sales training. I was 23 years old, literally had never, you know, Zig Ziglar was a name I had heard of, but it didn't, you know, maybe I don't think I'd ever read a page of his books or listen to any of his audio, cassette tapes at the time. So yes, it was a very intimidating process. I'm not going to be, I'll be honest, it was intimidating for me, because I would say most of the meetings you come into, they'd be like, how old are you? And, you know, you have to get over the hurdle of being young and quote unquote, then they look at you like you're inexperienced and whatnot. So it took some time, quite honestly, it did. But once you kind of got your confidence under you and realized that, you know, these business owners need help. They're not all the smartest people in the room, and you do have something to offer, and you can get over that hurdle. But that was my early memory of sales.
Now, we know Flynn got you in, right? You were working at the car wash. So Brian Flynn, you were thinking, and you were already on the street trying to sell something like this. What made you want to sell advertising? How did you think about that?
You know, ironically, Tom, when I was in college, our fraternity, I put together a publication and sold it, and we raised money for charity. And we did it for an event that we did as Sigma Chi at Florida State. We gave that publication out to all the sororities during the week and had all the events in there. I sold advertising for it. And I loved it back then. We did it. It was very easy. And when we first started, we did get, obviously, in any sale you make, you're going to get kickback from customers. Everyone's not going to say yes right away. But what he and I did, we didn't give up, because we knew more than anything that we had to succeed. And the only way that and he had to do it for his parents, and I had to do it for my parents, because they were telling us we were crazy.
No, I didn't want to get a real job. That was the honest truth. And I said, if I can just stay in this gig, that means I don't have to get a real job. So that's
why he borrowed $10,000 from his parents.
$2,500.
He did not want to give that. We borrowed $10,000 from the bank. This is in like year two or three. But he borrowed money from his parents. He did not want to be a failure for that. And I didn't either. So, Tom, one of the things we did today, which I don't know that too many reps do this, we went out every single day. You did not want to come back to our office unless you made a sale. Every day, it didn't matter. We were making a sale. And what do you have to do for that? You got to be persistent, and you've got to make enough phone calls. So if you're not out there calling enough people, and then obviously you got to have a sales pitch, and you got to know what you're saying. I mean, that's a given, and how you're going to help the business grow. We had that, but we were both very persistent, and neither of us wanted to fail.
The more you speak with the Bryans about their success at Mint Magazine, the more you hear them talk about work ethic and everything they put in to being successful. I asked them, was there any other particular thing that jumped out that was important to you? And has anything changed in how people are successful today?
Enthusiasm is contagious. And if you're enthusiastic and you can put a smile on your face and can put some words together, you can get an audience in a lot of instances. I will say what's changed today on the street is I think the access to business owners is a lot harder today than it was when we started out. They weren't getting flooded with the amount of marketing and vendors and people calling on these businesses that are going on today. So a big advantage we had in the late 80s, early 90s is just getting access to decision makers.
Yeah, because it was a new product. So that did make it easier.
And then you did most of it. You had to get in front of them and show them. And then from there, they took off, right? So, but as you grew, right, you're now Mint Magazine. I know when I first met you guys, your book, it was kind of like the who's who in Jacksonville. I mean, you guys have some really great clients that you're working with, some big names. That had to be a different type of sell, right? So what's going on in the evolution of Mint where suddenly you have some really large companies taking you, looking at you and starting to work with you?
You know, I think one of the things, and Irv came up with this, you know, even in our sales process, the qualify, interview, educate, sell, close. But it was when we were going through that sales process, when they were doing that, and Irv took a letter, basically a solo postal letter with a stamp on there, and came up with that process. And we actually took and figured out what the value of a customer was to a business. And I think our sales really changed when we did that. When we determined that, hey, you only need a few responses to have this advertise and pay for itself, that was a turning point when we actually came out with that structured sale.
I think another turning point, Tom, I think too, just the basic validation of direct mail. I mean, when you look at direct mail as an industry, it was in its infancy in the late 80s, in the very, very infancy, you know, early days. And I think as businesses started to see that, hey man, these coupons work. They put butts in seats. They get people through the door and they make the phone ring. You know, I want more of this. And so we still fought the negativity of discounting and couponing and all that kind of thing was still, there were still those people that are against that. But I think it was just as businesses saw that the vehicle worked, it brought them business. And then word spread, you know, and that's how this thing really built up quickly and how we were able to expand into other markets as well.
You know, Tom, you mentioned when it turned the corner. Part of us turning the corner, though, was also he and I were doing all the work ourselves. Then we hired my brother Kevin as our first coworker employee. When we started hiring people, so we were taking all of our profits. He and I weren't taking them. We lived on very little. I mean, we were eating ramen and we were young kids.
Is there at least a little furniture now in the house?
Yeah, we have a little furniture now. But Irv had a roommate that was a manager at this place called Fat Tuesdays. So, hey, we had free drinks. So we had drinks and we had, you know, very inexpensive to operate. So we actually started taking that money and we invested back in our business by hiring people. And that really was a turning point for us, because when you hire them, you know, it's a lot easier to put out a publication with more than just the two of us.
But it sounds like, so kind of walk me through, because I think this is where a lot of business owners struggle. So you're out there, you're both driven, you have that desire, you're both being successful, you're persevering. You get to a point now you need to start bringing other people into your organization. Now, to the last time I remember talking with you guys still ran accounts. So you would still sell, you would still handle that. But now you also have to run a business, right? You got to manage people. You got to deal with the ups and downs of their life. You got to make sure they're showing up for work. How did you change from just doing it yourself and knowing what was going to get done to being responsible and accountable now for an organization?
I think one thing, our partnership benefited us, because then you could obviously, you had, you know, there's other people could do other things and so forth. But I think we were fortunate with our original hires. They did a good job. The business, it was a lot easier than it is now. I'm not trying to say it was easy, but it was easier in the sense that once you establish an effective name, you could walk in and say, hey, I'm Brian with Mint Magazine. You know, I'd love to have a few minutes of your time to sit down, whatever. Businesses in those days would say, it'd be 50-50, 50% of the time they'd say, sure, I got time right now, or here, let's make it a meeting, et cetera. And it's not that easy today, as everybody who listened to this knows, or is out there selling. So I think we were able to hire intelligent people. We didn't hire droves of people at a time, so it wasn't like you had 20 people that came in and simultaneously, where you had to train them, get them up to speed, and all that. It was kind of just a couple people every 6 months, or that kind of timeline is how I recall it, and you just kind of absorbed it at that time.
Did you prefer being out there talking to clients, selling or managing the business? What
we both did it all, Tom. So the number one, we needed sales. So he and I, during the day we sold, and then we did artwork at night. So in the initial phase, even when we had artists, we still did our own artwork. So that's how we had to survive. You had to do everything. I mean, every aspect, from cleaning the toilets to bringing the trash out to, no matter what it was, you did everything. So we did that literally until the day we left the business. And we both still managed accounts all the way to the end.
The Bryans brought up a very important part of direct mail. We are responsible in direct mail for results. And in order to get results, we have to design beautiful ads. Because the Bryans were so involved every day on the street talking to clients, it showed that they had a leg up in understanding how to build those ads. I asked the Bryans what that was like in the beginning.
Well, you got to look at desktop publishing and how it evolved. So you were limited, to some degree, very limited in the late 80s, early 90s with the software. So PageMaker was the software of choice at that time. Then it went to Freehand, and then CorpusPress came on the scene, but probably 10 years later. So as the software changed and developed and improved, the ability of what you could do to an ad changed, and you could do a lot fancier ads. And back when Brian mentioned the hand stripping the film and so forth, that was done by a human being with an X-Acto knife in their hand on four pieces of film. And so the simpler you made the ad, the less expensive it was to produce, for one thing, because it was less man hours, labor. And so as the software improved, it gave you the ability to do different things. And yes, the ads improved over time, and I think became more effective because we were able to do more unique things with them.
Were those the key things? Was it that creative stuff you put in the ads, or was there something else that really worked for clients? What were the key things?
You got to have the offers. You got to have the offers. So again, no different than the first day we started. A bad offer generates poor results. A good offer generates good results. So that hasn't changed since the beginning of time, and I don't think it will. So it was all about the offer. It was still about the offer. And we learned very quickly that it was about the offer. And so I think that as you get that kind of experience, it really helps you as you move forward and educate others coming into the business.
Yeah, Irv had a thing. What is it, Irv? 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds? What was it?
It was a 3 second rule.
3 second rule.
1001, 1002, 1003. If I don't know the exact industry of the business, what they're offering, and so forth, in 3 seconds, it's probably a poorly designed ad. And I'll still look at an ad that way today.
And that's important for anybody, no matter what they're selling now, right? You've got to get people's attention. Even if you're doing social selling on LinkedIn or, you're doing something on Facebook, well, you better get their attention, really quick if you want to sell them anything.
Hey, listeners, it's Kelly Bloomer here to tell you the show is brought to you by Bloomer Associates. If you visit our website found in your show notes, you'll find we offer sales training, talent assessment for hiring and team development, and individual coaching for sales pros and managers. We bring over 30 years in media sales and leadership experience. If you enjoy listening to OK Boomer, Teach Me Sales, ask how our team can work with your sales team for virtual meetings, roundtables, and motivational seminars. You can contact us through our website or call today, 919-267-9871. Now back to our show.
So I asked the Bryans, they premiered their magazine in the late 80s. They've been partners working together now for the better part of 3 decades. What makes a successful partnership? How are they existing? How are they still getting along today and still looking for future things together?
there's no difference between this, Tom, than a marriage in a sense. I mean, you've got to be willing to give and take with each other. You've got to respect each other's opinions. And hey, one thing which is very hard for me, but you got to realize when you're wrong and the other person's right. And you're not right all the time. And hey, as hard as that is, you know, we never had, each of us never had all the right decisions or right, you know, ideas. And so it's literally feeding off the other person. You know, I don't know that I want to be in business without someone like Brian McCaffrey, because it makes a difference. You know, when you've got, you know, your yin and yang together, and you know, I think it makes a better, stronger partnership, because a lot of the times, and most of the time for us, I think it kept us from making mistakes. If we both couldn't agree on something, a lot of times we wouldn't do it. And Tom, in the long run, it ended up being the right decision.
Yeah. And the other thing, I think the core to it too, I never had to worry about whether Ryan Flynn was putting in 100% effort. You know, you had that was just inherently built into the partnership. So if you knew both of you were busting your butt and it was, you could zero question to that. I think that's what makes most partnerships break up, because somebody's doing the heavy lifting. And
somebody's chasing the girls. Is that what happened?
Yeah, somebody's chasing the girls, right? So I think that's what it comes down to. A core partnership is you gotta have just a complete faith that the other person is pulling their weight. And without that, I think it's and that goes back to a regular marriage, obviously. And I think without that, I don't think any partnership survives, personally.
And what I'm sensing too, and you talked earlier about you didn't want to go back to the office without a new piece of business. You're also holding each other accountable, right? You don't want to disappoint, you know, which I think a lot of people, when they're on their own, they don't have that same accountability. There's nobody kind of that they say, you know, I have to get this done today.
My biggest competitor was Brian Flynn. I mean, seriously, we were competitive. I mean, let's make no mistake, we are competitive to this day. And I think that was another driver for our business, because neither one of us were going to, you know, it wasn't trying to, like, we wanted to beat each other up, but it was like, man, if he's doing that, I'm going to do this. Or if he's selling that, I'm going to go sell them. And I think there was a built-in inherent competition between us that made us both work harder and then make everybody around us work harder too, I think.
I agree. I think it is. But, you know, Tom, it's so funny. I think one of the biggest, you know, we both fed off each other. And, you know, in a perfect thing, if you don't agree to something, you go, you just don't do it in most cases. One thing we didn't do, which we both agreed we wanted to do, we actually brought a guy in for an interview. We were trying to develop a website, Mint Savings. And Irv came up with a phenomenal plan. He and I literally sat there. He did most of the work for this on this case and designed everything, came up with these packages. We started selling them. He was out there selling the majority of them, which was phenomenal, getting good money for him. And that was back in early 90s, 92, 93, 94.
Well, that was late 90s was when we launched that website.
So we launched the Mint Savings. We had a guy come in there and interview with us, and he wanted, I think, $110,000. Or something. At that time, he and I were both like, holy shit, we can never afford to get in this segment of the business. And we both wished that we had. And we probably should have interviewed some more folks, because that was one. And obviously, we brought our Mint Savings site along later years. But right then, I think we could have capitalized on more of the market.
That was the beginning of the beginning of the...
We were on the very beginning. But we were getting good response when we first launched it. There was a tire place in Jacksonville called Paul Lewis Tire. And she gave us my brother Kevin got a free oil change out of her for everyone that joined the site. So we accumulated a lot of emails, got the emails, and that was a good kickoff to it, coming up with a compelling offer that people wanted to sign up for. And that made a huge difference. And I think that's in anything you do today. If you've got a compelling offer, people will use that compelling offer.
So after many years together, after putting their heart and soul into growing a business as partners, it came to a point where Mint Magazine decided possibly to begin looking to partner with someone else. I asked the Bryans what led to that and how did it come to be.
In 1994, we had a babysitter babysit for us, and she ended up going up to Pennsylvania. And ironically, she babysat for Bob Zuckerman. And she came back end of the summer, babysat for us again, and said, hey, I met these guys that own Clipper magazine. I babysat for them. I'm like, holy crap. I called them up that next Monday. Well, Steve answers the phone. It wasn't Steve that she babysat for. He just played along. It was actually Bob. And so we struck up a friendship. And in 2002, so we just talked periodically, just, and it struck up a great relationship.
Because you're not in any competing markets or anything at this point, right? Just
no, we were all in, no competing markets.
So, started around the same time, right? They started in the mid 80s, I think, as well.
They started a little bit before us, a few years before us. But so we struck up that relationship, and I think it was in 2001 or two, we actually flew up to Lancaster and met them. And we were working out through attorneys to actually expand in other markets together. And we thought we had an agreement that we were going to go expand to different markets together. And Steve called up and said, hey, I apologize. We just sold our business to Gannett. So that at that point ended it when they sold to Gannett. And we were already in Chattanooga, Knoxville, and Columbia.
In Tampa.
And we were in Hillsborough County of Tampa. So they were in Pinellas County.
That must have been a fun phone call.
Yeah. we were looking forward to going doing something with them. And I was more disappointed because I wanted to work with them. I really respected Steve. We had talked to Rob Bliss at the time. Hadn't met Bob or Ian yet. But we went and we expanded this. One of our old partners who's unfortunately passed away now, Lee Weaver, he really wanted to expand into Pinellas County. So we expanded into Pinellas, started competing against Clipper. And it was a couple of years. It was actually in December of 2004. Irv and I had put together a monster of a magazine and we mailed it up to him. It was right around Christmas time. And Steve,
you mailed it to Steve?
Oh yeah, we mailed him copies of it. And just okay. it was like 100 and something page book. It was pretty nice. Mm-hmm. And so we mailed it to him and he called us back and said, hey, we would love to work with you guys. So we then, it took us about 5 minutes and we all agreed that we were going to go work with them. And we closed a few months later and became part of the Clipper magazine. But that was, I don't know that we would have sold, Tom. I think one of the reasons we did sell is we were selling to somebody that had a lot of the same visions that we did in their business. And it made sense with us because when we expanded in other markets, we took partners on in those markets. And it made it an easier exit for everybody at that time.
So. I think back then when they sold to Gannett, I think part of that was as a plan with working with Gannett to expand to more markets and to grow. So it sounds like you and Steve, they were all in a similar mindset at that point. No one knew where print was headed, but you know, we're in a similar mindset.
You know, you think, Tom, and also you got to look at the kind of the stages of your business. And when you go into business, and somebody a long time ago told me, this guy, very successful guy, says you start a business for one of three reasons. You start a business because you're gonna make it your career, or you're gonna start a business, you want to make it your career and leave it to your kids, leave a legacy, or you're gonna start a business because you're ultimately gonna sell it. So every one of those things has an exit strategy. So we're 19 years into running our own business, and there hadn't been any acquisitions in our industry to speak of, any sizable acquisitions. And when Gannett made this acquisition, I think there was also a question is, hey, is this time the right time? Because how many more Gannetts are there out there if you wanted an exit strategy? Again, we were not forced to sell. We didn't have to sell. We were making great money. It was really just the opportunity and just the trust that we had in Steve, Bob, and Ian and Rob that really kind of just made it feel comfortable. Say, hey, we can do this. And they were interested in staying in the business, and neither one of us had anything. I mean, I was 40 years old. I was like, I got game left. Let's go. You know? So, you know, basically we were all still in that age, you know, bracket where we were like very, very hungry, even though we were pretty successful at the time.
So after working on their own, forming a partnership, growing a business, joining a large company like Clipper Magazine and Gannett Media, there's a lot of change going on. I remember when the Bryans came to Clipper, they were responsible for also bringing a lot of enhancements, a lot of idea sharing that things we learned from that they were doing. They helped start the deal business at Clipper with what they started there. They had to show a way of adapting to change and working through change. I asked them to share with us how does someone learn, or how do they appreciate how important it is for them to be adaptable?
Part of it, you gain that through experience, through just things that happen. You know, this change is going to continually happen, and I kind of chalk it up to experience. But yeah, you've got to be able to roll with the punches a little bit, and I think as you get into a larger organization, you realize that your impact, if you know, or if you go away from that organization, it's not going to just fold up and go away. So you got to kind of look at how do I make myself as valuable as I can in this organization, because they can move on without me. So I think part of the adaptation is also there's a survival mode there. If you want to really break it down to, if you want to stay in the business or stay in a career or in an industry, you better accept the fact that it's going to change and learn from it.
Yeah. If you're not changing, you're going backwards. And we always, Tom, that's one thing we did. We always looked at different categories as we grew our business. There was different segments. I mean, at one point it was a satellite business. I mean, gosh, we had so much satellite business in there. We literally had waiting lists from satellite companies. We had carpet cleaning, small independent guys that were growing. We had waiting lists. Pizza guys. I mean, there were so many different categories. And we kept saying to each other, okay, what's the next big thing? Well, we didn't know. And this is what we did. We did evolve into this, the home improvement business. So at that point, there wasn't even a whole lot of home improvement stuff within our publications in the early 2000s. And that started to expand. So we always were looking at the different categories and things we could do, no matter if it was postcards. So we started doing DAL cards back in the early 90s. We actually had an affinity business that was telephone. We literally, we did a citywide mailing for that affinity business. We got checks for 10 years for one or two mailings. So we started doing the postcards at that point. And so we were always trying to figure out new types of products instead of just, you know, resting on your laurels and saying, hey, you know, I'm comfortable. I don't want to change anything. We are always trying to improve it and try to improve what does the consumer at the mailbox want to see. And in our business to be successful, it was really three things. The consumer had to win, the business had to win, and then we would win. So as long as those first two were achieved, then we had a success in anything we came up with or any category that we came up with in our business.
Because there aren't as many businesses that have to have all three of those, right? I mean, you could do a great job selling the ad, but if you didn't deliver a good product that the consumers used, it didn't matter how good a salesperson you were, right? You had to get it down, and I'm guessing there's certain things in your control. There's certain parts that weren't.
You know, hey, and what it was, Tom, we say all that stuff. What also helped us is as we did this, when you say the ad's got to work, we then developed an art department and we hired the right artists. Luckily, you know, we were blessed to have the right people on staff. They then made a difference. Because then they could create ads that they did that for a living. And as long as they were creative, then that helped us.
And here, the good thing about the business, obviously the magazine, direct mail magazine businesses, you have a lot of advertisers. Yes, you got some bigger advertisers, regional players or whatever, what have you, that pay the bigger portion of the bills you got to pay. But at the end of the day, each one of those businesses is its own game. It's either going to succeed off that ad or it's not. And you learn by failure, trial and error, and looking at an ad. If once the business owner tells you, hey, I didn't get any response from this ad. Well, if you go back and study that ad in virtually every instance, you can come up with some reasonable conclusion of why that ad didn't work. Whether that business was brand new and had zero name awareness and bought the smallest ad they could buy because they didn't want to buy a full page, or, you know, there's some reason that ad doesn't work. And I think you learn from that, and at least we did. I know we learned from it, because that's how you made changes and adjustments and adapt and say, hey, that doesn't work. Well, here's what works. And goes back to the offer. And again, back to the offer in a lot of the cases, that you can look at it very clearly and say, well, we made this darn offer a little too complicated for the consumer.
And I like the way you said, you go back and say, hey, that's not going to work. You need to do this. That you have to have some of those uncomfortable conversations with your clients up front, right? You can't just say, hey, what do you want to put in the ad and hope? You got to sit down and really show them, right? That can't always be easy.
You can look at newer reps into this business right now, Tom, and I know you've seen it dozens and dozens of times. Those newer reps that until you understand that you've got to manage your client, you can't allow your client to manage you. And a new rep, it's very hard to be in that situation looking at a business owner until you have the experience under your belt, because it wasn't easy for me starting out, and I would listen to the customer and do what they said. But I figured it out, and then that, hey, we made a mistake here, and actually it's because the customer forced me to word it this way or do that offer or this offer. Well, once you get enough confidence, you can go back to the next customer who tries to do that and say, here, let me tell you this is not going to work, and here's why.
I think confidence, that's the key word there. They have to have, because if you're desperate, if you just need to walk out with the sale, you're not having that uncomfortable discussion with them.
That's exactly right.
Okay, gentlemen, I didn't prep you on this, but I want to talk about memorable sales. I have one particular sale that I'm convinced, in looking back, if a particular Little Caesars franchise owner had not bought one of my front covers when I was first getting started, I don't know if I would have still been in advertising. That was kind of a monumental sale for me. It gave me confidence to keep going. I'd love to hear, do either of you have a pivotal or memorable sale that really sticks out?
Irv actually already mentioned it, and it was one of the first sales I made. It was to Ed O'Neill at Texaco Express Lube. And there was two businesses. It was Ed O'Neill and Terry Fowler, and they had competing oil change businesses, and I sold both of them. But those sales right there, I mean, it was in the first months of our business. And yeah, Tom, those were some of the memorable ones. And I think they're most of their memorable ones because they were both neat guys. That I really respect. So I think that made a huge difference for me doing those sales. And they were big sales back at the time for us. But I mean, there's been other neat sales, but I think that was the first one that I really, really enjoyed.
Very good. Irv, do you have one?
I've got one, and it evolved over about 5 or 6 years. When we had been in business for about 5 years, I got the confidence to say, hey, I'm going to go call on this Fortune 500 company called Winn-Dixie. And Winn-Dixie at the time, in the middle of the 90s,
was a little bitty grocery store, right? Just a, you know, not that big.
With a few hundred locations. And I would call up Winn-Dixie's marketing director every single year. And to his credit, he would give me 15 minutes. He would set up an appointment, and we would go into the waiting room of Winn-Dixie, which was the most intimidating waiting room you've ever been in. All the vendors are in there with their different supplies and so forth, waiting for their opportunity to go in and make their call. Well, my number would get called up, and I'd go check in, and I'd go get my 15 minutes with the marketing director, who would shake my hand afterwards and say, hey, thanks for coming in, and I'll call you if I need you, that kind of thing. Because, you know, technically they could lose more money in one rainy day than we could ever generate in a lifetime of their business. But so every year I would go back and do the 15 minutes, and this guy would give me the time, and it was really great that he did. But I said to Brian Flynn one time, I said, I'm going to make a sale this time. I said, I'm not going in there and spending 15 minutes. I got a relationship built up with this guy, and I found out he really liked fishing. So I said, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna go to the pet store, and I'm gonna buy him. I went in and got a jar, and I bought a Japanese fighting fish, and I put water in it, and I got a net, and I got food, and I got a Mint magazine cup, because when you change the fish, you got to put them in another object so you could put them in the Mint magazine cup. And I sat in the waiting room with my box of supplies for my meeting with Winn-Dixie,
And I go in and we
spent looks from anybody in the waiting room, right?
Hey, it was all covered up. I had a towel over it and all that. So we go in and I get the 15 minutes. And just as the 15 minutes ends, I said, Bill, and that was his name. I said, you know, I've been coming in here every year, and every year you're very nice. I said, but this year I'm going to leave you a present. I said, and I brought the jar out and I put the fish up on his desk, and it was he just sat there and looked at me. I said, oh, it's a Japanese fighting fish. It's cool. It'll just sit on your desk. And I go, hey, when you change the water, here's a net and here's some food and here's a Mint magazine cup. You can put them in here. And you always think of me when you change out the water. So I left and I said, by the way, if you don't do an ad with me this time, I said, every year this prize, this gift is going to get bigger and it's probably going to get furrier too. So I had this whole thing going up and I literally then got his attention, and we actually did a deal. We did a 2-page spread for Winn-Dixie based off of that meeting. And the best, most rewarding thing about it is I had two friends of mine that worked for Procter & Gamble at the time, and they were out for dinner at that night with Winn-Dixie. And he, Bill, I won't give you his last name, but he was at the dinner and started telling a story about this sales rep that brought him a fish. And the whole place went bent over backwards laughing about it. And that was my most memorable sale. But leading up to that, you've got to be willing to make the sale of reasonable doubt. So if you're not going to make a sale in a business, it's okay to walk out of there and go, did I make the sale of reasonable doubt? Will this business think of me when I leave here, or when they get into the market? You know, if they get into direct mail, are they going to think of me or somebody else? So I try to tell people all the time, I go, don't be afraid about not making the sale. Just make sure you've made the sale of reasonable doubt. You want them thinking about you. And I always, that was my significant sales story for me personally.
Which then led to Procter & Gamble advertising with you a lot.
That's accurate too. So we got Procter & Gamble for a few mailings. It was pretty cool.
So guys, let's talk. It's 2021. You've been in print now for the better part of almost four decades. Where are we at now? What's going on in print? What's changed, and where do you see it going?
Still very, very effective. Again, back to what we've talked about, you know, this whole call is just basically, it's got to have the right offer, the right call to action. I think print can be highly effective, but I think print right now is in a challenging situation. I think it really does well when it's bundled. So you obviously have a major digital component, digital, you know, options out there. And I think when you roll those into it with a print program, both of them work more effectively. I think there's, you know, much harder to get to business owners. I mentioned that earlier. I think the actual getting to decision makers is more difficult. And there is this constant, conversation that print is dead. And I think print is anything but dead. I think print may become more targeted than before.
They've been saying it's dead for 15 years.
Exactly. Exactly.
We always said, and this was probably starting in the early 2000s, we were all going, oh my God, our business is going to be dead in 5 years, 10 years. And we kept looking at it. And I don't think that today. And as Irv was starting to say, targeted, you can solo direct mail. You can do within products like Mint Magazine, you can do a DAL card. You can do insert cards. You can target, you can hit demographics. It's phenomenal. I think print is anything but dead. And here's why. There's so much in the early days when we first started, we would pick up that phone book and that thing would be, you know, 8 inches thick. It was crazy, some of those things. And then obviously the phone book went away with the online, with Google, and people, you know, search for their sources other ways. Now there's so much fragmentation out there more than ever. There's really one way you can guarantee to hit every single home, and that's direct mail. Direct mail, you can still go out there and you can hit every home in the target audience that you want very effectively. So that's the beautiful thing about direct mail.
It shows up in the mailbox better than ever because it's not as crowded as it used to be, right? There's no bills in the mail anymore. It's fun. People get good things. So I think it's showing up more. And you mentioned targeting. I can't even imagine where targeting may be in 3 or 4 years because of what you can already do. You can mail a postcard to my house. My neighbor may get a whole different picture or a whole different offer in the very home next door. I mean, could you have envisioned that back in 1990?
Absolutely not.
No, and I think our magazines, Tom, once the technology advances even more, I think all of our magazines will be that way, where I could literally change an ad out from one home to the next as they become more digital. So as the big presses then become digital presses, then literally every single home could get a different magazine and a different ad on that magazine.
Wait, that would, can you imagine that? You know, the bloomers get the magazine in the mail, and you know, Kelly and I haven't eaten at this restaurant in 6 months. Boy, they just put a really nice coupon to get us back. You know, great. Irv's going out to eat all the time, so they just give him 5% off. They don't have to give him a whole lot. They know he's coming in. I mean, it's amazing where it's probably going to go. You're right.
You know, the other challenge, though, you got to look at the challenges as well. And the challenge is postage, is the post office. Where's the post office going to be in 5 to 10 years? What is that going to look like? And we've all heard about it. And there was just an article recently about, you know, the $160 billion in debt they're in right now and changing delivery dates and things like that. So there are unfortunately some headwinds from that standpoint that's out of our control or out of direct mail, the direct mail operators out there control, but I'm sure they're all watching those conversations very closely.
But as of today, when he says that, so the post office, it used to be 3.3 ounces. It's now 4 ounces for a third class saturation piece. And one of the keys in our business is make sure you hit that 4 ounces. Irv and I realized that a long time ago, Tom, and I think that's why our mint division was so successful, is that we sat there and we looked at those books and knew that printing would cost us X amount. We could do this much in revenue. Well, that gross profit on those additional pages were phenomenal. And just to get to that close to that 3.3 and now 4 ounces. And so we tried to utilize as much of that as we could.
Got it. Every seat on the bus needs to be full, right?
You got it.
Absolutely.
So for an extremely successful direct mail company like Mint Magazine, I think you're getting a feel today of what the Bryan's partnership meant and why that organization was so successful. But I asked the partners, was there one key factor? What was the main reason Mint Magazine became the organization it did?
And fortunately, we were blessed with a very loyal group of a staff that, you know, coworkers, if you will, that worked with us. Many of them, you know, when we sold the company, many of those people have been with us for years and years and years, and even years later, they're still there. And that's really just, you know, it was just a testament. We got fortunate with really bringing on quality people that did a great job for us, that were, you know, that you know, they bought into what we were selling, and that's what made it possible.
Yep. Yeah, not just sales reps, but internal folks too, Tom.
Absolutely.
Incredible. Yeah, how many are still there?
A lot of lives. A lot of people were very happy and very successful being a part of Mint Magazine. So it's an amazing thing. Guys, great story. I hope to have you on in another year because I want to hear what you do next. I'm sure there's still some good stuff. It sounds to me like Irv is still, you know, you're not 40 anymore, but you sound like you're still chomping at the bit. Let's go, right?
Going out right after this. I'm going out to knock on some doors now, Tom, just to see if I get my nose bloodied today.
Fantastic. Stay creative and have fun. And guys, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And it's been great.
Thanks so much for having us, Tom.
Always good catching up with you.
So that's it. That's today's show. Okay, Boomer, teach me sales.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and follow. We hope you make us a part of your week. And don't forget to share with your friends and coworkers.
Should we mention the website?
Sure, the website, OKBoomerTeachMeSales.com.
And where can they engage with us?
LinkedIn @ThomasJBloomer.
We hope to see you there.